A rare public grilling for the Vatican. Today, January 16th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Catholic officials are questioned by a UN committee investigating clergy sex abuse. This longtime Vatican watcher had never seen anything like it.
This is an unprecedented occasion to see senior Vatican officials grilled over allegations that the Vatican protected paedophile priests at the expense of victims for years.
But this victim isn't sure the church will really ever be held accountable.
The Vatican is 2,000 years old. It's very good at constructing itself in a way that means that no part of it is ever responsible for anything if it doesn't want to be.
And later, the daughter of Uzbekistan's leader takes to Twitter and proceeds to overshare.
She found herself in a family drama worthy of Shakespeare, and she's been tweeting about it all.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Plenty of reminders today about how controversial the Catholic Church is. In Hollywood, 4 Oscar nominations for Philomena, a movie about abusive and corrupt nuns. Half a world away in Geneva, a very rare public grilling of the Vatican. It happened before a United Nations committee investigating child sex abuse. The Vatican is actually a signatory to the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. The committee asked church officials about the Vatican's repeated failure to protect children from abuse. Archbishop Silvana Tomasi told the committee that child abuse of any form could never be justified and that the problem extends beyond the church.
Abusers are found among members of the world's most respected professions, most regrettably including members of the clergy and other church personnel.
Tomasi said the Catholic Church is committed to dealing with the problem, but is this enough? Jane Little is a former BBC religion correspondent who's done extensive coverage of the Vatican sex abuse scandals.
I would first say that this is an unprecedented occasion to see senior Vatican officials grilled over allegations that the Vatican protected paedophile priests at the expense of victims for years. It is unprecedented in that regard. In terms of the defence, there was a lot said about how wrong abuse is, how it's both a crime and a sin, and also how the church has instituted policies to protect children. All true. That said, there was also much made of the fact that local bishops and law enforcement have to deal with abusive priests, not the Vatican. And while that is actually technically true, it is, to say the least, somewhat disingenuous because there is written evidence that the hierarchy in Rome actively obstructed police investigations.
Any sense of why finally the Vatican agreed to answer questions about the scandal, especially in such a public setting with the UN there? Do you think maybe Pope Francis had a hand in this?
Yes, to some extent. I mean, the Vatican ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child in 1990, so technically it was supposed to come and account for itself here. But you know, more decisively, it's because it would know it would be a big PR mistake not to go. We've had intense criticism of a culture of cover-up and obfuscation with strong evidence in multiple cases that the Vatican's put the protection of the clergy and the church's reputation before the protection of victims and possible future victims of abuse. But I think it was also due to the fact that there has been a change at the top. Pope Francis has dramatically shifted the tone. And now the new emphasis is about a church being on the side of the poor and the people. And the Vatican needs to be seen to be following through on that.
Yeah, a dramatic shift for sure. I mean, Pope Francis called the sex abuse scandals the shame of the church. Where do things stand with the Vatican's internal struggle with these issues? Is there still active debate about how to deal with this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Vatican may be an institution like no other in that, you know, it's a centuries-old monastic court run by men. But they are men. You know, we have ambitions, petty jealousies, intrigues. We saw that with, of course, the butler's extraordinary revelations of clerical corruption and sexual intrigue. We see infighting at the Vatican as we've never seen before. You know, this is supposed to be about cleaning up house. That said, you know, this is not an institution that's ever been about openness and transparency and accountability. It's not a democracy. So in many ways, today we saw this fascinating culture clash between a fairly obscure secular committee hearing and this old monastic institution.
And with Pope Francis there leading the church now, I mean, he's Time Magazine's Person of the Year, Internet celebrity. And yet we have this stark reminder of the challenges facing the Catholic Church.
Absolutely. More strikingly, he's the gay magazine The Advocate's Person of the Year last year. Who would ever have thought that could happen just 2 years ago? There's been a remarkable turn in the fortunes for the church leadership in terms of the way the media's treated it. Pope Benedict could do no right. And now it's almost the exact opposite in the media's eyes. The secular media's almost made him a saint, if you like. So I think this is a reminder that there are real issues here. There's a long way to go in resolving this biggest of many issues facing the church.
Former BBC religion correspondent Jane Little there. Today's hearing may have been a start on that long road, but for those devastated by clergy sex abuse, the Vatican opening up is only a start. Colm O'Gorman was abused by a Catholic priest in Ireland. O'Gorman wrote about it in his autobiography, Beyond Belief. He also founded One in Four, an advocacy group that supports men and women who've experienced sexual violence. O'Gorman says he was encouraged by today's UN hearing in Geneva.
It's another moment, hopefully, towards the eventual ending of the Vatican's impunity for not just its failure to address the crimes of its priests, but its oversight and creation of a system that actively covered up those crimes. It's certainly in my view, and I think the evidence is clear in that regard.
So while it is only a start, it is an encouraging moment for you in kind of the whole narrative of the scandal?
Yeah, I mean, if I reflect back, I mean, I was 14 when I was first abused by a priest. It was sort of 1981. And it took me 13 years to even get to the stage where I could consider reporting what had happened to me. And I mean, I'd fled my home, I'd moved to another country, I'd fled Ireland and was living in London at that stage. I'd broken all contact with my family and then gradually, 4 years later, re-established contact with them. But it took a very long time for me to even imagine speaking about it. And you know, naming these kinds of crimes is always difficult, but naming crimes of rape and sexual assault when the perpetrator is a priest and when the institution that one finds oneself eventually having to go up against is one of the most powerful institutions on the globe is a pretty daunting thing, most particularly within a country and a society where priests were unquestioned and unquestionable and where, you know, in every Irish home there was likely to be a picture of the Pope, and they were the biggest authority in our lives and in our state. So naming those facts in 1994, 1995 seemed barely possible. And getting to the point now where we've, you know, seen the breaking down those beliefs that institutions like the Catholic Church and figures even as high as popes could not possibly facilitate the commission of these kinds of crimes, we've begun to break that down. And I think that's incredibly important.
In your book, Beyond Belief, I mean, you describe how, like so many other victims of the sexual abuse scandal in the church, you were just suffocated by helplessness. Did you tell anyone from your family about the abuse?
Not when it was happening. I can remember on one occasion, before I became completely trapped by the priest who was raping me, trying to tell my mother that I didn't want to go with him. He was down at the bottom of the stairs in my house and I was up in my bedroom crying, saying I didn't want to go. And my mom, bless her, was running up and down the stairs between the two of us, trying to understand, but obviously not being able to imagine what the problem might be and me not being able to tell her. So I couldn't tell her. And then it was only about 6 or 7 months after I finally fled my hometown when one of my sisters found me, and I told her sort of what had happened. I told her that there'd been some sort of interaction between me and this priest, and it was clear what I was talking about, but I wasn't able to name it fully. And as soon as I'd said that, I fled it again and didn't return home for another 3.5 or 4 years.
And you didn't have the best relationship with your father, but eventually, finally, you were able to speak with him about the abuse. How were you able to get there to that point?
When I told my sister, when I told Barbara, she told my dad, and I was always terrified of him finding out, not because of what he might do to me. I didn't fear him, but I really feared the impact of him knowing, as I saw it at the time, both what I had done and what I had been involved in. I was terrified of the impact of that on him. When I went home after 4 years, we couldn't be in the same room alone because we couldn't speak to each other. We were that uncomfortable with each other. And then when I finally had gotten to a point in my life where I was starting to stop running, was the best way I can describe it, and I realised that there were things that I had to face about my past and that this was the big thing that I needed to deal with. Coincidentally, it was New Year's Eve, 1994, And at a party in her house, my father, who was a man who didn't speak of his feelings very much, drew my sister and one of his friends into a room, and he broke down and sobbed and said that he hadn't slept for 12 years, knowing what had happened to me and that something had to be done about it.
Wow.
And my sister called me and told me, and I rang him the next day and said, "Dad, I want to do something about this too. Let's do something." And a month later, with his support and with my family's support, I returned to Ireland from London and made a statement to the Irish police, and that began the investigation.
I mean, it's upsetting and distressing to hear these stories, because these are kind of successive moments where you are opening up more and more about the abuse to different people. So with the Irish police, was that just, you know, you're opening up and the courage starts to come? Is that what happened?
When I reported it, first of all, I believed that I was going to tell the police about one bad man who happened to be a priest who did some pretty terrible things to me. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they would act to hold him accountable, but also to make sure that he wasn't doing it to anybody else. Within 6 weeks of me reporting, the detective involved called me to tell me that another five men had now made statements about acts of rape and sexual abuse that the same priest had committed upon them when they were young teenagers as well.
Incredible.
Within a year, I began to discover that the Catholic Church had known, first at the local level, then at the national level, and then at the international level. At every step as I discovered this information, my outrage grew. Not my distress, but my outrage. And that's what led to me finally deciding in 1998 that I would institute a legal case against the priest, absolutely,
but against
also
the
against
church.
The bishop and against the Vatican. Yeah, I sued the Pope in 1998.
I mean, as you say, where you grew up, people had a picture of the Pope in their living rooms, practically everyone. I mean, so what did you hear from people in your community when you decided to sue the Vatican?
People thought that I was naive and foolish. And I suppose people at that point certainly didn't believe the Vatican and that the church at the institutional level could possibly be responsible for this. I mean, I had no desire and have no desire to bring the Catholic Church down. I'm not a religious person. I'm no longer Catholic, but I'm not, you know, on some fundamental level opposed to religion or opposed to the Catholic Church. But what I do want to end is the impunity that the Church has enjoyed. What I do want to end is its capacity to continue to allow these appalling crimes within its own ranks to go unchecked, including, in my view, the most serious crime, which is the cover-up of those crimes. I mean, the priest who abused me was responsible for what he did. Every single offender, every single priest who decides to rape a child or a vulnerable adult is responsible for that individual act of abuse. But an institution that seeks to cover up those crimes and does so in the interest of protecting its reputation, its authority, is one that needs to be exposed. I've never set out to harm the church. What I have set out to do is, ironically enough, I suppose, stand for the principles that I learnt from the church, the principles of truth, of honesty, of justice, of love and compassion for others, and of a sense of responsibility for other people and for their well-being.
Colm, after all that you've experienced and been through, did today's UN panel with the Vatican, did it give you any sense of vindication, or you kind of need to wait and see what happens next?
Well, you know, funnily enough, I don't need vindication. I haven't ever really needed that, I guess. I mean, I was blessed ultimately to have enormous support from my family, my partner, and those that I love. So I didn't need, at a very deep personal level, to be believed or to be vindicated. What I wanted and what I continue to want is justice.
Colm O'Gorman in Dublin, thank you for telling us your own story of abuse and your extraordinary path out of that nightmare. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
If you haven't checked out The World Through Flipboard, you really should. Flipboard is what would happen if this radio show became a magazine. Our stories become pages you can flip through, and at the same time, you can hear those same great stories. The Flipboard app runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device, and as you can hear, it's pretty darn cool. You can find it at flipboard.com/theworld. Still ahead, a dictator's daughter is in a bit of a bind. We'll explain later on The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. If you order a drink in Poland, it's probably going to be vodka. Even though Poland is the largest producer of apples in Europe, there's not much of a thirst there for cider, the alcoholic kind, that is. But two young Polish entrepreneurs think they can change that. They're brewing their own hard cider, which they hope will catch on in Poland's bars and clubs. Liam Nolan has their story.
Tomek Porowski worked as a lawyer for a pharmaceutical company, but he dreamed of making cider.
The smell, I think, is better than cider before. I think it's less sugar.
Yeah, it's less sugar. I personally prefer the one. The one from the 6 varieties, not the one from the 4 varieties.
That's Marcin Hermanovic. He and Tomek are sampling the latest batch of their artisan cider. It's called Ignatsov Cidre. The Hermanovic family has grown apples here in the village of Ignatsov for 4 generations.
I think about 100 people lives here, small village. All the people here are fruit growers, so nobody else.
In fact, this area, Gryaz County, is the largest apple-growing region in Europe. But despite the millions of apples here, cider production has never taken off in Poland. During communism, it was illegal for fruit farmers to produce and sell even a single litre of their own alcohol. That ban remained largely in place until 2011. Then the government relented and allowed growers to produce up to 10,000 litres of alcohol per year. That year, Marcin and Tomek teamed up to become Poland's first commercial cider producers.
The funny thing was what we observed, you know, there was on the shelves in shops, there was cider from France, there was ciders from Ukraine, even cider from Ireland, but there was no cider from Poland. So something was wrong and there was definitely a niche.
But it wasn't an easy task. Marcin's apple-flavoured moonshine had a bad reputation in Poland.
In the communist time, the cheapest alcohol in Poland was so-called wino owocowe. It was apple juice that you add some sugar into it, a lot of sulfur, a lot of bad things.
Dealing with cider's historical baggage was one thing, but the new law gets in the way too.
In fact, this new regulations, it's many, many hidden problems.
Tomek switches back to Polish to explain the red tape.
Chcieliśmy nasz cydr rozlać w profesjonalnym miejscu.
He says they wanted their cider to be bottled by a professional company and they needed to attach government-approved customs labels to the bottles. But it's against the law for another company to attach the labels. Tomek says the law forgot about producers like them.
Zapomniała o takich producentach jak my.
So Marcin says they came up with their own solution.
We needed to sell our cider to that company and then buy it back. This, we are, you know, the first. So there is a lot of, I would say, can you say in English, holes in the law?
The guys are now selling their cider in 3 Polish cities.
I think this is the new opening of cider in Polish life.
Yeah. Na zdrowie.
For The World, I'm Liam Nolan, Ignatsów, Poland.
Pay a visit to a local pub and you might find that there's a big cider renaissance here in the U.S. as well, especially here in New England where we grow a lot of apples. I'm talking hard cider like the one we just heard about in Poland. As for regular cider, the non-alcoholic stuff, that never went away. But making it yourself? Now that's a tradition that's largely gone the way of, you know, sewing your own clothes. But The World's environment editor Peter Thompson and his family recently got a fresh taste of that old tradition.
My grandfather was an apple farmer. His farm's still in my family out in the hills of western Massachusetts, and it's still got a few of its gnarly old apple trees. A handful of Cortlands, a few northern Spies, even a rare old blue pearmain from a family of apples that goes back 1,000 years or so, and somehow or other happens to share its name with my own family. My mom was Anne Pearmain. We keep the old trees because we love them, but they're pretty much played out when it comes to producing apples. Or so we thought. But this year, there was something in the air in New England. Seems it was a banner year for apples all over, and even these geriatric trees got caught up in the frenzy. So just as the first frosts were hitting, my family and some friends went up to the farm and started picking. The old trees are mostly a tangle of dead branches and new shoots, But once you get up in them, the apples seem as thick as grapes on a vine. And the ones you can't reach? Well, sometimes you can just shake them off the tree. Add those to the pretty good drops already on the ground, and you've got bag after bag to dump into the tractor bucket. That's Kyle, one of my daughter's friends. We were all pretty amazed by how many loads we ended up hauling up to the house.
How's the picking?
Endless.
My wife Edith took charge of sorting the apples. Some were definitely keepers for eating. And most of the rest, well, slice off a wormhole on this one and a really rotten edge on that one, and you got a mountain of cider apples ready for the grinder.
Daddy, what is that?
This is where things started getting really fun for the kids.
He's on it, trying to eat.
The grinder has a little orange chute on the top that's pretty much an invitation for a bunch of little kids to toss things into. The apples rumble down the chute, and out of the bottom, it spits out stuff that kids just love. Mush. The mush gets dumped into the wooden presser, and on top of that, there's a big crank.
Too fast.
Turn the crank. The mush gets squeezed, and before you know it, there's the cider pouring out the bottom.
Can I
turn? Sure.
When we need the apple cider.
Oh, we already started serving some, remember?
Yeah, let's get a little closer.
The kids had a blast learning how something they love gets made and helping to make it themselves. And I had a blast sharing that experience with them. And knowing that we were all getting sucked back into this swirl of deep history. Back to New England 200 years ago, when apples and cider were staples of just about every household. To Europe 1,000 years ago, when growers first started giving their local varieties names like, well, pearmain. And to the mountains of Central Asia maybe 5,000 years ago, when people first started cultivating apple trees. From there, apples spread to every inhabited continent and weaved their way into local and global culture like no other fruit. They even got Adam and Eve kicked out of the Garden of Eden. There's a lot going on in one little jug of cider.
One, two, three.
For us, by the time we were done, we had more than 100 gallons. We gave a lot of it away. The kids took some to school for show and tell. And the rest, we stashed in a big old freezer. It might not last us 1,000 years, but we'll be drinking it for a good long time. For The World, I'm Peter Thompson.
We've posted some great pictures of Peter's cider adventure. Find the slideshow at PRI.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, vigilantes in Michoacan. A veteran reporter in Mexico says there's a reason private militias are roaming the streets.
The military's had thousands of soldiers here for more than 7 years trying to take on the gangsters and haven't really done anything.
Plus, a bit of baby talk that's ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Necessity, they say, is the mother of invention, and people in the western Mexican state of Michoacán are experiencing a primal sort of necessity. They need protection. They've seen drug cartel violence go unchecked by police, so they've picked up guns to defend themselves. At least that's what seems to be happening in Michoacán. Global Post reporter Dudley Althaus is there, following these so-called self-defense militias. He spoke with me earlier from the city of Apatzingán.
I'm standing right now in the central plaza of Apatzingán, which is the epicenter of all this. There's heavy traffic, including some police, federal police and military patrols crossing through town all the time. I'm looking right now at two truckloads of heavily armed federal police. Yesterday, we spent the day with the militiamen in a town called Nueva Italia, which is about 20 miles from Apatzingán. They basically had control of that town, and we saw 30 militia gunmen armed with AK-47s, AR-15s, and various caliber pistols.
What's it like being with these guys, Dudley?
Well, it's very calm. These guys are really very welcoming to outsiders. They're a lot of young guys, between, I'd say, 18 and 22, 23, most of them. We talked to a number of guys on Wednesday who had spent their childhood in Southern California, in the L.A. area. Some of these guys get paid by whoever's paying them, but a lot of them are kids that in civilian life and normal life they work as fruit pickers, or we talked to a guy who worked at a box factory before he joined these guys. In some ways, these younger guys are kind of enjoying this. It gives them purpose to their lives, and they think they're helping their communities and helping their people.
They seem to be battling a drug ring known as the Knights Templar. Who are they, and why did this group in particular foment this group of militias?
The Knights Templar are sort of a quirky, quasi-religious organization. They have their own code of ethics. But the Knights Templar have controlled Michoacan for more than a decade in various forms and under various names.
Are they more dangerous, the Knights Templar, than other gangs and cartels?
Well, they've proved kind of brutal in this area. There have been a number of beheadings, and they're very much into extortion. Everyone here will tell you the Templars deny that. But everyone here will say they extort people at all levels of society, from shoeshine people to the richest magnates. And so what you see is a lot of these guys say even them as themselves as lime pickers get extorted per box of what the limes they pick. People are just kind of fed up. You hear that everywhere here.
Now, you've met the leader of this network of militias going after the Knights Templar. Is a doctor named Jose Manuel Morales. Tell us about him and why he got involved.
He's a family physician, and he was really involved in the local PTA, Parent Teachers Association, in his hometown, Tipicatepec, which is one of the first towns that rose up against the Templars back last February. He spent 10 years in California, Modesto, California, as a migrant, worked with the Red Cross there, worked with Michoacan migrant organizations in California.
I got to say, Dudley, the way you describe these militias, they sound a little like the salt of the earth, just pushing back against this cartel when the real police weren't doing the job. But I gather there's some speculation that these militias are fighting on behalf of a rival drug gang. So who trusts them?
There is a lot of suspicion of that, and it's a possibility here. These kids are pretty well armed. They have AK-47s, some of them old, some of them new, AR-15s, assault rifles. They say, the militias say, that they've gotten their weapons from local business community and local leaders or have captured them from the Templars. But there is suspicion that they're working on behalf of the Cartel de Jalisco New Generation, which is out of Jalisco, the neighboring state, of which Guadalajara is the capital.
We've heard some reports that Mexican soldiers have made attempts to disarm the militias. What happens when they do that?
They did attempt to disarm the militias on Monday in a town very close to Pansingan. A lot of the local townspeople came out, tried to block them, the army from entering the town. The military shot in the air, and then they shot into the crowd, killing two. And since then, actually, the government has not tried to disarm the militias.
What occurs to you when you see this going on, Dudley?
These people are filling a void left in these communities. The military's had thousands of soldiers here for more than 7 years trying to take on the gangsters and haven't really done anything. And so the militias say they formed to fill that void. So, I mean, it's really a damning indictment of a lack of effectiveness of the federal forces and the federal effort here.
Dudley Althaus with the Global Post, thanks very much for telling us about these guys. Appreciate it.
No problem.
What you have there is a situation that is no longer about public safety. It is no longer about crime per se. What you have there is something that is approaching a low-intensity armed conflict.
Alejandro Hope is keeping a close eye on the unrest in Michoacan. He's director of security policy at the Mexican Institute for Competitiveness in Mexico City. Hope says Mexico's government has been of two minds when it comes to the self-defense groups.
The federal government has had a schizophrenic policy vis-a-vis the self-defense groups over the past year. Initially, they saw them with a lot of suspicion and even tried to disarm them in some localities. But over the course of the summer and the fall, they probably started seeing them as functional allies in the fight against the Templars. And this led them to adopt a policy of tolerance, adopting in, even in some cases a full-on cooperation with these groups, probably because they saw them as a way of fighting something of a proxy war.
I got to say, if this had happened in the United States, people would be throwing their hands up in the air and saying the federal government's incompetent.
Well, to some extent, what this shows is the weakness of Mexican institutions, of Mexican law enforcement and criminal justice institutions. What this shows is that, particularly at the local and state level, you have something of a void. You have only a carcass of an institution and not really a lot of substance.
So how is all this affecting Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto? Came into office promising to reduce violence a little over a year ago. Is he delivering?
Well, to some extent, homicides nationally have declined, driven mostly by improvements in northern cities. But, I mean, there's still a huge challenge. Mexico last year probably had, I mean, the final number is not in yet, but probably had somewhere between 23,000 and 24,000 homicides. That's about 50% more than the U.S., with one-third the population. So this is something that will not fix itself. This is something that is not likely to improve radically or dramatically. This will be a long slog. This will be a long, will require a number of changes, a number of reforms, some of which are underway, some of which are merely incipient, some of which haven't really started.
What kind of changes and reforms?
Well, first and foremost, there's a reform of the criminal justice system that is moving the system from a written inquisitorial system to an oral adversarial system, more akin to what you would find in the U.S. That is a long-term process that is going on at the state level, but again, it's slow-moving. Secondly, police reform. Some states have moved along that direction, particularly in border states, northern border states, but others are laggards. Prison reform. Most Mexican prisons are overflowing. They are ruled by the inmates themselves. There's very little control from the authorities. And, of course, you need also a reform of social conditions that allow crime to reproduce itself. So, and, I mean, this is a very broad agenda, and that does not lend itself to easy solutions.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of work and perhaps something that a lot of people have been saying should have started years ago.
Well, yes, partially we're paying the price of negligence for many, many, many years. I mean, over the past decades, there have been some efforts at reform. However, those changes will take many years to bear fruit.
Alejandro Hope at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
She's been called the most hated woman in Uzbekistan, also the most powerful. She's Gulnara Karimova, the 6-foot-tall daughter of the country's autocratic leader. Natalia Antalava's had a rare relationship with Gulnara Karimova, and she's done a radio documentary for the BBC about that relationship. Now, I spoke with you about a year ago, Natalia, about Gulnara. Remind us who she is and how you started corresponding with her in the first place.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure relationship is actually how I would describe it.
Twitter but, relationship.
Yes, a virtual relationship. Gulnara Karimova is a pop star. Her stage name is Gugusha. She's a diplomat. She's a businesswoman. And recently, she's also become obsessed with Twitter. So I tried my luck and sent her a Twitter message. And we are, you know, it's important to remember that we are talking about one of the most reclusive countries in the world. I mean, arguably second only to North Korea. Mm. So suddenly when I got a reply to her, I literally almost fell off my chair. And this conversation on Twitter carried on. But what has been a lot more interesting has been her Twitter feed, which turned from sort of a place where she would post pictures of herself at fashion shows and in various yoga poses into the single most important news source on Uzbekistan. Because a lot has been happening in Uzbekistan recently. It involves Gulnara herself. She found herself in a family drama worthy of Shakespeare, and she's been tweeting about it all.
You've never actually spoken with her directly, Natalia, but you do have a recording of her speaking, I gather.
I do. Gulnara doesn't give interviews. She doesn't like to answer real questions. But over the last few years, she has hosted many people in Uzbekistan. Among them was a lesser-known American actor, Peter Allman. And in conversation, in a recorded conversation with him, she made a quite significant statement.
How would you feel if you were president of Uzbekistan?
Well, I probably will not be able to answer this question before I will try it.
And this is, it was the first time that she indicated what was had been rumored for a long time, that she had presidential ambitions. But very soon after that, she seems to have fallen out with her father, Islam Karimov. So over the last year, she, one by one, her empire crumbled. She lost pretty much everything, from her businesses to her TV stations. Her charity was shut down in Uzbekistan. And you know, she says that this is part of a fierce battle for succession, and she has blamed her father's top security men for what's happening.
Yeah, what's the fallout with her father all about?
Well, from what we understand, and it's hard to know for sure with Uzbekistan, her father found out about a corruption scandal that she is involved in Europe. She's accused of receiving a huge bribe, $300 million, from a Swedish telecommunications giant, a company called Telia Sonera. And from what we understand, her father found out about all of it, decided to look into her other excesses, got very angry with her, and decided to clamp down. That's one version of the story. The other version of the story, and that's Gulnara's version of the story, is that what is happening to her is a battle for succession, and that is her father's top security man who is the mastermind of it.
So a corruption scandal, maybe a battle for succession, and on top of all this, Gulnara Karimova is now tweeting about human rights and her concerns about human rights. How credible is that?
That's right. One of the extraordinary transformations of Gulnara in the last few months has been that she went from basically, you know, being the fashion queen into tweeting about torture in Uzbek prisons, about arrests in the middle of the night, about things that are really part of reality of life for many, many Uzbeks. And it's a very interesting development because she's clearly standing up to the regime of her own father. However, you know, I think many people don't believe any of this because her record is dark. I mean, the U.S. Diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks have once described her as a robber baron. And while doing this documentary, I met Uzbeks who live in exile now, who are still absolutely terrified of being identified despite being very far away from Uzbekistan, and who say that their businesses have been taken over by Gulnara and that they suffered a great deal when she decided to take over their businesses.
I mean, this is really serious stuff. I mean, what is the likelihood that Gulnara might come out on top of this power struggle? You know, going back to that clip, I mean, she might like to try the presidency. What would that mean for her country and the region?
Well, right now, her presidential ambitions seem to be in tatters. But she still matters for the future of Uzbekistan, for the stability of the entire region, because it depends on Uzbekistan. It's Central Asia's largest country. It's also a key country for the American withdrawal, for the NATO withdrawal from Afghanistan, because it provides one of the alternative routes from Afghanistan. And the reason why she matters is because for over two decades, her father ruled unchallenged with an iron fist. But now he's facing his own daughter, and his future basically hangs on what he's going to do next and whether he'll be able to control his disobedient daughter.
That was the BBC's Natalia Antalava. And you're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's still a lot we don't know about how we start speaking. You know, exactly how we pick up language as babies and process the grammar as we go along. Two new studies cast light on the early stages of language acquisition, and The World's language editor, Patrick Cox, is here to talk about them. So the first study, Patrick, is about parents' baby talk. Does it help with language acquisition? It's just annoying, mostly for me.
Annoying but possibly effective, Marco, as this is a study out of the universities of Washington and Connecticut. And they set out to figure this out, to see how many words that infants were picking up, depending on how much of this baby talk they were exposed to. And the ones whose parents engaged in more baby talk to them at age one, by the time they turned two, they'd picked up 433 words on average, as compared to 169 words for the babies whose parents were more reticent in their baby talk.
So how do we know it's really the baby talk that's making the difference? I mean, what would happen if you just spoke normally to a child using all sorts of different vocabulary words?
That is a very good point. We really don't know that. It could just as easily be that any kind of one-on-one attention to the infant is going to be just as good as baby talk. It could be that parents who interact a lot with their kids without going all coochie-coochie-coo are just as effective in passing language along to their kids.
So the second study, Patrick, I gather, is about recognizing different languages. What are we learning from this study?
Well, this is a study out of the University of Auckland in New Zealand. The researchers in this case, they wanted to find out if infants as young as 13 months could distinguish between languages. So the kids were shown videos of nursery rhymes in French and in English. And by the way the infants reacted, it was clear that they understood that words and sounds varied from one adult to the next, the French to the English speaker. Of course, they didn't recognize these as French and English, but they were quite easily able to grasp that the speaker of one language could call, say, a car, une voiture, and the other one would call it a car. So they appeared to know that words are not shared by everyone.
Does that study play any role in our understanding of how people actually get the ability to speak two languages, you know, bilingualism?
It's more evidence that certain patterns lock in very early in life. Other researchers found that infants as young as 6 months old can detect sound from a language not in their environment, and that by the age of 10 months, they lose some of that ability. That said, there's also another study that followed much older kids, Korean kids aged between 4 and 8 who'd been adopted by French families and were living in France, immersed in the French language. And they mastered French as if it were their mother tongue. Their brain activity reflected that of a native speaker. So that's somewhat conflicting evidence about this aspect of language acquisition.
The World's Language Editor, Patrick Cox, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Marco.
And to hear more discussion of those studies, as well as why some cultures use the word sorry much more than others, check out our podcast, The World in Words. That's at pri.org/language. Finally today, we turn the mic over to our DJ friend in Norway. He's got another one of his musical favorites to share with us.
Howdy, folks. This is Marius Asp speaking to you from Oslo, Norway. For this DJ pick, I've chosen one of the most mysterious and haunting albums to come out of Norway in a while. The debut album by the solo artist Carmen Villen, titled Sleeper. Let's start off with one of the most straightforward songs off the album. Seemingly, at least. Here's the opening track, Two Towns. Behind the name Carmen Villen, 27-year-old Carmen Hillestad has been one of Norway's few international top models for a number of years. But there's little glitz and glamour to be found on her debut album Sleeper. Quite the opposite, in fact. Most of these songs are experimental, challenging, and occasionally disturbing, trading in conventional song structures for a deeply original take on the style known as shoegaze. Dreamy, brooding in hypnotic art pop in the vein of introverts like My Bloody Valentine and the Jesus and Mary Chain, but with a fresh approach to it. Take, for instance, the downright creepy Obedience. You're listening to Carmen Villan and her debut album Sleeper, which is really starting to make an impact outside of her native Norway. The album is far from an easy listening experience, and it demands patience and dedication from its listeners. But there's a lot of beauty to be found on the album underneath all the friction. Music that sounds almost dreamt instead of written, feverish and glowing beneath the icy surface. So let's close this DJ pick with the album's most chillingly beautiful moment. Here's Life is Sin from Carmen Villan's Sleeper.
Trippy and glamorous shoegaze, music I wouldn't know about if it weren't for Marius Asp of NRK in Oslo, Norway. The World is produced by Jeb Sharp and Clark Boyd, with Bradley Campbell, Andrea Crossan, Joyce Hackle, Carol Hills, Shirin Jafari, David Lavallee, Nina Porzuki, and Tracy Tong. April Peavy is our director. Our editors are William Troop, Jennifer Gorin, Aaron Schachter, Monica Campbell, David Barron, and Peter Thompson. Chris Wolf is news editor. Our managing editor is Jonathan Dyer. The executive producer of The World is Andrew Sussman. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Join us online at PRI.org, and we're back on the radio tomorrow.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.